You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of January 30th, 2013, and today we make our escape. Welcome back to the Experience Points podcast, where recently, Scott and I have been playing Escape the Room puzzle games in preparation for this very podcast.
So, George.
Yes.
Does it even make any sense that we refer to Escape the Room as a discrete genre? And two, are we the only ones that do that?
So, in terms of... I'll answer your second question first. Right. No, we're not the only ones that do that, actually.
Okay, good. That's
actually
reassuring.
Really common, right? Like, if you Google Escape the Room puzzle, mm-hmm. you'll find actually a lot of websites that are devoted specifically to this type of puzzle, mm-hmm. right? And they're not just, like, genre pieces you'll find on Kongregate. Like, there are forums dedicated to sort of Escape the Room scenarios. What's kind of weird is I actually don't know if there's a good repository of constantly updated games, because it almost feels like the quiet release of this type of game. Now, whether or not it's actually its own genre, I don't know. I mean, I think that in many ways I would just call it a subgenre of point and click adventures.
I mean, that was going to be my exact question. Like, I'm trying to divide that in my head. You know, is it any different from a point and click? Because, like, in every point-and-click adventure, even if you're not trying to escape a literal room, you're trying to figure out what will unlock the next screen.
Yeah, so I think that's a good idea. Let's talk a little bit about what the differences are, right?
Like, yeah.
So one of the first PopMatters articles that I wrote had to do with Escape the Room puzzles.
I remember this.
Yeah, so my comparison was actually with single-room films in cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And them as a subgenre. And we've got examples like Rope, which is a Alfred Hitchcock film. We have examples like Buried. It's a relatively recent film about... The entire film takes place inside a coffin of someone who's buried alive. There's that film Phone Booth that mostly takes place inside a phone booth.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When Kiefer Sutherland threatens What's-His-Face.
That's right, yeah. What's-His-Face.
Colin Farrell.
Colin Farrell, that's right.
How about, isn't there one with J-Lo in it?
J-Lo, Jennifer Lopez. There's a film called...
Jenny on the Block, if you will.
There's a... Yeah, so there's a film called The Cell. I don't know if I would include that.
I have never seen it.
It's pretty weird. I think you should watch it sometime. But anyway, there's, you know, it's actually not entirely that unique of a genre, right? Single room films mm-hmm. are a thing. And mm-hmm. single room... trap scenarios are a thing, right? Mm-hmm. Dial M for Murder, right? Another Hitchcock film takes entirely in place in one room.
Yeah.
And there's something special about it. And I think that what makes it special is the feeling that all of the aspects of the story, everything from the solution to the puzzle in the case of these puzzle games to all of the conflicts that will take place in the case of Dial M for Murder, mm-hmm. everything is represented physically in that room. Right.
Mm, yeah. No backtracking. No, like, I remember this item takes place in this screen, so I should go back. Yeah.
I mean, and things start to take on new meaning when you start looking at them in that way and in that angle, right? Like, especially in the films, you get filmmakers who have to think of really clever ways to shoot it, right? Mm. So you get sort of long side angles, or you get scenarios that are putting cameras in such place as to really feel as though you're being confined within this space.
Mm.
And other times, the camera's put in such an angle so as minor objects in the room are suddenly shown with great significance, right? Mm-hmm. All of this, I think, is relatively unique or at the very least heightened in that type of cinema. Mm-hmm. And I think that we can say this, we can apply that same type of experience or feelings in Escape the Room games, for the most part.
Yeah, yeah. That makes sense about the economy of the physical space.
One of my favorite things about Escape the Room puzzles is the feeling that all of the answers are just there, and I'm just waiting to get to them. Mm. And I think that you could say, well, this sort of exists in Escape from Monkey Island or, you know, all of the other point-and-click adventures where I know that 8 screens away there's a tavern, and in that tavern is a barkeep, and that barkeep is the solution to a puzzle on this pirate ship, which is 12 screens away, right? I can go ahead and make that that assumption. But I think there's something special about having such a confined space and knowing that all of the solutions are there and they're just waiting for me.
Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, do you think that there's that much of a difference between an Escape the Room puzzle and a single room in Portal or Portal 2?
Yeah, it was funny. I was going to make that exact analogy, like, because as you were saying, you have all the tools and you know that, well, and that's kind of the brilliance of Portal, basically, is that at a certain point it becomes not an Escape the Room game, and you thought it was an Escape the Room game, you know, all along. But, like, you know, the first half of Portal or whatever, yeah, like, it kind of has that similar vibe, you know? I wish we had portal guns while we were trying to escape this room.
I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, Portal is just a 3D Escape the Room puzzle, right?
Yeah. Like,
you have all of the tools. I mean, some of the most memorable and exciting moments of the Portal series are when I'm stuck, right? I don't know how to progress. And I'm just sitting there, and I'm looking at my surroundings, and I'm trying to do the math. I'm imagining all the different ways that this single portal gun and the various objects in the room can result in my escape, right? Mm. That's not really that much different than a lot of the Escape the Room puzzles. It's not that much different from the Submachine series, which has a little bit more mobility in terms of Escape the Room puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates that sense, that aha moment, or the feeling of like, gosh, I'm so smart, I was able to work things out on my own, in a way that's different than, say, Drop 7 or other types of puzzle games that aren't in such confined spaces that you can actually sort of maneuver through.
True, yeah.
I also think there's something special of just, like, clicking on shit.
Like, well, then I have a game for you. It's called Farmville. Well,
that's actually a somewhat good point, but I think clicking on things in this confined space and, like, and because one of the cool things about that I think is unique about Escape the Room puzzles is the feeling of a mystery hidden beneath the mundane, right?
Yes, definitely.
In a way that's not necessarily always true for point-and-click adventures.
Or something like Portal, because, like, it's completely, you know, sci-fi, you know?
I mean, there's those moments in Portal where if you're sneaky, you can get behind a wall and see scrawlings on the wall, right? Mm-hmm. Those moments are the closest to creating the same sort of feeling that Escape the Room puzzles do.
Right.
But if we were to compare the Submachine series, right, of Escape the Room type games to Escape from Monkey Island, right? It makes sense that we find a piece of rope and we find a monkey and some rum, and together that makes, I don't know, a monkey tightrope walking scenario, exactly. Right? Like, all of those things we find are there. Like, it makes up the world. Whereas if I turn a head of a statue three times and open it, it gives me a glyph that I can then apply to another room, right? Like, the sense of mystery and magicalness in that experience is heightened because you are fiddling with the mundane, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a couple Escape the Room games. I don't know if you've played them, but I think listeners should try them out because I think they're really funny. And one is Escape the Closet. You're in, like, a really tiny closet. Like, that's it. The whole thing, you're in a very small closet. And the other one is Escape the Car, and you're just stuck in a car.
Mm.
And all of the puzzles and all of the pieces to get out of the car are in the car.
Mm.
You know, I love the idea of hiding the solution behind things that are seemingly everyday.
Yeah, yeah.
Clearly, I think there's something special and valuable in Escape the Room type puzzles, and I actually got to talk to a game designer recently about his work on the Submachine series.
Okay, so my name is Mateusz Skutnik, and I'm the co-founder of the Pastel Games. We are located in Poland, and I'm the sole creator of the Submachine and Daimler Town. And also 10 Gnomes, and I co-created the COVID Front series with Karol Konversky, who is my business partner in Pasta Games.
Cool. And how long have you been involved in game design?
That would be from 2004, so it's like 8 years and going. It's been always a flash. So that's the first and the only scripting language that I learned and mastered to some degree, of course, that lets me express what I want to do in games. So from that point on, I'm just involved in Flash.
So you say what you want to do in games as though you sort of have a philosophy. Can you share that with us? Is there something you want to accomplish in your games in particular?
Not exactly philosophy. I wouldn't go that much, but I have my own perspective on what I want to do in games. And the best ones, I think, are those created by very small designing teams or perhaps only one or two person, because then the so-called artistic vision is most clear.
So in particular, I'm interested in the Submachine series that's been going on for quite some time now. Can you talk about what that series is for those listeners who don't know what it is, and a little bit about why you started that series?
Well, the Submachine is it's not exactly the escape room game. It's more of an exploration game, but we learned that in the second part of the game that was released in 2006, and the whole series started in 2005 with the first installment, which was like a very small project, only for, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes of gameplay. In Submachine, you are trying to presumably escape the series of rooms that are interconnected, and you move between them and solving the puzzles. But as you go, then you learn that it's much more interesting to stay in those structures than to leave. So let's say from the second or third chapter, the idea of the game is exploration, not escaping.
A lot of the Submachine series in particular is really atmospheric and environmental. Can you talk a little bit about the importance of that tone when you're designing these games?
I think the tone is the second, or maybe the first, the second most important thing after gameplay for such games, because the immersion is quite difficult, because there is no protagonist, there is no hero in this game. There's just you and a set of rooms, and you don't know what to do. So to achieve the proper immersion, you need to lay down some heavy arms like ambience and whole atmosphere. The gameplay has to be very smooth and very forgiving and very inviting for a player, which maybe sounds a little bit counterintuitive, because it is a puzzle game. But it has to be, inviting all the same. There's a fine line between, making a game that is just very difficult for a player and borderline that you wouldn't be able to finish it without a walkthrough or solution.
Right.
And finding that little spot that I know what my player wants to do, and I know what he will do. And following that path, that's the main thing in escape games, to predict the thinking of a casual player. Maybe not casual, but the average player.
So when you're designing one of these games, how do you decide what sort of theme you want to take with it? And does that modify the puzzles you create, or do you start with the puzzles first and then sort of move into the story and the atmosphere?
Well, the designing takes place right with the exact creation of the game. Mm-hmm. I create comic books also, so my working process is create as I go. So it's all together, the atmosphere, the locations, the puzzles, and everything is done quite on the spot. As I find myself is in some situation that I need to create a puzzle or another location, then I just think of it and make it. So there is like no foreseeing of what I'll do and where I'll finish. But it will come to me. That's the nice thing that when you start, when you immerse yourself in creating a game, a world, then you find the right things to do.
So according to the website, you actually have some training in architecture and you describe yourself as a Flash Games architect.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how your knowledge of architecture shapes your approaches to game design and the Submachine series in particular?
Well, it goes beyond the architecture, the actual outlook of buildings, of course, in my games, but that is a big part of it. The main thing about being an architect is that you have to think about every single aspect of the building, of the design process in the, simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So when you think about laying the pipes or, you know, making the electricity or the roofing or everything, you have to, you know, put it all together at the same time. And that's how I approach my games. I make the programming, the art, the music, the puzzles, everything at the same time.
What is the hardest part of making games like these?
What is the hardest? That's a tough question. Honestly speaking, there are no hard parts in making those games. I just love making those games, and I don't really see what would be... Maybe, you know, there is a point after when you finally make all the story in your head, make all the puzzles, then you have to somehow force yourself to just create it. to draw it and you know, to script it and everything like that. So after, you know, you finish this creation, let's say, thinking part, then you just have to do it. And maybe that's the hardest part because the creational part is the most exciting thing about making games.
So earlier you had mentioned that the Submachine series isn't exactly an Escape the Room game.
Yeah.
How would you define it in terms of genre? And is there a clear distinction to you between, say, point-and-click adventure games and the Submachine games and Escape the Room games?
Well, that is a point-and-click adventure. That I'll admit to this. But Submachine is just Submachine. And that's a puzzle adventure, and that's it. And I don't know what genre I would slap onto that, but you know that's an adventure, I think. I don't know.
And then also earlier you had mentioned difficulty. I'm curious to know what are your thoughts on hints and cheating, and how important do you think challenges to the experience of playing these types of games?
That's completely irrelevant, actually, because there are always the people who like to solve the game by themselves. Mm-hmm. I mostly enjoy when people are commenting on my games when they say they were playing for 4 days, for example, and were grinding and finally did it and they feel fantastic. That's the right spirit. And if somebody wants to, somehow spoil the fun of solving everything, then okay, that's okay. The walkthroughs are usually a few hours after the release of the game, so it's, you know, it's unbeatable. Everyone can. The main challenge is not to look at them, right? To solve the game by yourself. I think that's the challenge of a escape game.
One of the interesting things I thought about the Submachine series was that there's this sort of ardent community around it, and there's discussions on the forum about what the game means and all of that. What do you think is special about this series in particular that makes it have such a strong community response?
No, I completely don't know. I'm thinking about this, but that eludes me. I know this game is kind of special because of the mechanics involved in the gameplay. The specific movement between rooms and such. I know there are hints of a greater story that is only uncovered in some parts, maybe this. Mm-hmm. And somehow it spawned the community of people who like to theorize, who like to talk about the Submachine, and I'm just loving it. And I must agree, I listened to them very carefully, and some of their ideas are in the Submachine because they were thinking about things that I wouldn't even, that didn't cross my mind, but were so in the right place for Submachine, so that I just used them. And that's, for me, that's a phenomenon that I really don't understand.
Is there something about the experience of this type of game that makes it unique, do you think, or that can't be done either in a written form or even in a real-life sort of puzzle game?
I don't know. I think that it is kind of unique because you have the author of the game somehow standing behind you, and you know that from the player's perspective. You know that solving this puzzle not only means that you are clever, that you did it, but there is someone that says, okay, you are clever, I know you are clever. That there is some kind of connection between the creator and the player. And it's kind of important because when I create those games, I know that there is a dialogue between me and the player. And this is very important because I feel that the important thing about playing such games is knowing that the player is intelligent and letting him know that. Yeah. And that happens through making such puzzles that are difficult, but, you know, to some degree are very logical. So when you create a logical stuff, then you're fine, when you're okay. When you create some, you know, crazy things that no one would ever think of, then you're just, you know, throwing obstacles at the player. And that's not about, that's not what those games are about. And I think that the main thing is the dialogue, as I said before, between the creator and player, and I'm talking to the player through the game. I'm saying, you can do this. This is right for you. This is a puzzle, but you can solve it. And when a player does it, then I get a response from them.
Yeah, from my own experiences, I think there's something special about being in a room or being in an environment and knowing all of the pieces of the puzzle are there. I just need to put them together. And there's a sort of faith that the game has in me that, well, here are the pieces.
Yeah,
now exactly. Use your mind to...
Yeah, that's the thing. But you know, the pieces can be completely insane. Let's say you have to use a hammer on a flower and then you get a rainbow, which is typically idiotic. But there are games out there that do just that. And that's a false premise of being difficult. Because that's not difficulty, that's just insanity.
So how do you make a game difficult then, from your perspective?
The difficulty of a game is, first of all, making a puzzle that's logical. That's very important. It can be very, very tough, but it has to be logical. Mm-hmm. And when you stick to this rule, this is the only rule of creating a puzzle.
So what's next for you then, in that case, for the Submachine series?
Well, the Submachine series continues happily until the Submachine 10, at least. Mm-hmm. We have the next one coming this year and the final one in 2014. Mm-hmm. However, that will not mean the end of the series, because after that I want to do more Submachines in form of standalone games. Because in mm-hmm. Submachine 10 we'll just finish the main storyline, which is spread along all those episodes from 1 to 10. This is all one story unfolding in each game. So when that's over, then I'll just stick to this. Like, you know, when the Lost finished, right? There were many questions left unanswered. So right. That's what I want to do. When I finish the Submachine with the 10, I know that people will have more questions that will be answered in those standalone games after that. And that's the future of Submachine. And also I have the Submachine Exploration Project, which is ongoing online, massive single player. When you enter and you have, I don't know, about 83 locations right now, that would be about 300 rooms.
Wow.
And that's mainly, for now, that's just exploring. That's just looking and finding new locations.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just a canvas for me. And when I finish all the locations, then I'll think of creating puzzles in them. And that will be massive.
Wow, that's quite an adventure.
Yeah, that project started in 2010 and is ongoing, and I'm about to create a new addition to the system. I came up with the idea after playing the game called, what's it called? The Mystery of Time and Space. Mm-hmm. You're probably familiar with this one because that's one of the founding fathers of the entire genre.
Yep.
And they were adding the levels as they went on, right?
Yeah.
And I thought of that. I thought of this idea that you have some kind of gameplay system that you can add on, you can add more bricks in the time, and it's working, and it's online, and it's free. And as I said, for now it's just exploration, but it will turn into a massive game, I think, I hope.
What attracts you to the design of this type of game specifically? Is there something that is particularly special to you?
Yeah, that would be the opportunity to tell a story, which is kind of strange because in Submachine there is not much of a story, but there are hints of a story. Mm-hmm. And we have this world that is unfolding in each game, and the story progresses. But for me, creating games is just another medium of telling the story. As I said before, I started with creating comics, mm-hmm. and I somehow translated that into gaming. And this type of game, the puzzle, escape, or adventure, or exploration, allows me to tell the story to the player, and I think that's how I connect with this genre on a another level of just being someone who tells the story.
So while you can play any of the Submachine games online, in San Francisco, there's actually a building with a little cafe in the bottom that is used as an art space. And starting a couple months ago, a studio from Japan brought over a real-life escape game. And yes, that is exactly what it sounds like. 11 people are locked in a room that is full of puzzles, and your task is to escape that room within 1 hour. Scott, Hanna, and I actually had a chance to do this. We played the real-life Escape the Room game ourselves and talked to some of the designers of the Escape the Room game. What follows is some of their audio, and we recorded it on site, so excuse us for some of the levels and the background noise, but hopefully it's interesting to you. And then afterwards, we'll follow up with our own discussion on what it's like to be trapped in a room for an hour with 7 strangers or so.
So, Kazu, right?
Yes.
Yuki.
Yeah.
Okay. Where do we start? So, you've done this before, right? This isn't your first time putting together the room game, because you brought it from Japan.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we ran this game in Japan around
5 years.
5 years
five
ago?
5 years.
Yes.
Okay.
And then we started this game from the March, last March.
Yeah.
Okay. And what is your background? Are you theater people? Are you game design people? What is your training?
Yeah, actually, I was a creative director in Japan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then the founder of this Scrap.
Mm-hmm.
Scrap is our name of company.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And our founder is my friend.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then I was here, we were here, and then they started to bring this game to the Asian country.
Right.
And then we were in San Francisco. And then they asked us, does anybody any chance to have the real escape game in the United States?
Mm-hmm.
Then let's get started.
Right.
Then we started.
Right.
What have been the reactions from people? Like, are you surprised by how well it's been doing? Has it been doing well?
How do you think?
As long as I know, people get really, really excited because they don't have a chance to mess up the room.
Right.
Because usually you're mother or father or your wife or husband, no, right?
Yeah.
But in this room, you can be child. You can do anything you want.
Right.
So I like to see the people, face, exciting, and running around. And, once they cannot tell them much, once they find something, they get really excited.
Right.
The next moment, they become so surprised and scream.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you decide, because you gave us hints at the very end. Mm-hmm. How do you decide when to give hints?
Okay, yeah. So basically, we do nothing is better. Because people will come to play this game.
Right.
And people want to solve everything by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we respect people and we respect their mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we want to give them. We don't want to give
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we want to help them, but we have to be patient.
Right.
And then, in the last minute, that we want you enjoy this game.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we have some rules to give hints. After, 15 minutes.
Right.
And when they didn't open the box and give them hints, there are some tools in this job.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Like that.
Interesting. And what do you think the most exciting thing about having a sort of puzzle like this is?
Yeah. Every moment they find the, you know, answer. Mm-hmm. Is there, you know, their joyful moment. Like, yeah, of course, opening the box and opening the door is a, you know, big excitement.
Yeah.
Like you have. Right.
Definitely.
Yeah, like a finding moment is like really...
Yeah. Aha moment.
Intense.
Aha moment, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Do you find that people generally cooperate really well together? Or like, what sort of learning curve do you think you see players have when they're meeting people for the first time?
First time, they're very nervous. But we have MC and they try to encourage to communicate a lot. So by the time game finish, they feel more comfortable to talk to each other.
Right.
And then during the game, it's very interesting. It's usually they're the one boss. I don't know why, but somebody play as a boss.
Right.
And then some people try to solve the one puzzle.
Right.
And then other people try to look for like floor, ceiling, not ceiling, like walls, and they divide the task. Mm-hmm. Even though we don't really say it, we say it, but they do it.
Right.
That's really great.
I think as you know already, so before the game, you guys are strangers. But after the game, you guys are a team.
Definitely.
Getting together. Yes. Interesting.
Do you think, what is something that we did today when we were playing that you think we could have done better? Because I feel like I'm curious to know what you guys have inside
you
knowledge.
You guys are experts, right?
Yeah. So how could we have improved our game?
I think in the beginning, you are really gentle and really... careful.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You could be more childish in the beginning. Like first 10 minutes, like, it was a really nice, like, can I touch? Like, can I flip over?
Right.
Go ahead and do everything.
Yeah.
You don't say no if you did. If you break the furniture.
Yeah.
Right.
So if you became a child from the 1 minute, I think you could have escaped.
Nice.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Good start is one important key to success.
Right.
Yeah. Because you guys are a little bit slow.
Right.
15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And once, you know, finding the clues and one more clue, and then you will be getting faster and faster.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you think we had a boss? Like, did we have someone that was with us? Was that a problem?
We need a boss.
I think we need a boss.
You kind of play as a boss.
I did.
Yeah.
Oh, I know that.
You could have it.
Yeah, and then you try to share the information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Not the bossy, but.
Right.
Nice boss.
But maybe I need
so
to be more
boss. George that we lost.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. I'm going to take the blame. Cool. Well, what do you think that you would say to someone who is a little hesitant to play a game like this? Is there anything you think that you would try to tell them to encourage them to play?
I would say you just try.
Yeah, just try.
Because you never know.
So,
great.
So, as you know, this game is pretty hard, pretty difficult. But people love challenging.
Mm-hmm.
So, we are making... because why this game is hard is we are... just not making a game. We want to try and make adventure, opportunities to adventure for people. So if you do nothing, so nothing moves forward.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this game.
Right.
So that's why we just challenge.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, and also I would like to say if you like puzzles and games, mysteries, books, movie, do like the Real Escape.
Nice.
Yeah. Great.
Cool.
Anything I think we've taken enough of your time. I know you got to set up the room again.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a lot of work.
Definitely.
So we've actually experienced real life Escape the Room puzzle ourselves.
We escaped.
We did it.
Wasn't
well,
escape from the mysterious room.
You're right. It was a mysterious room, which actually I think raises some interesting issues about themes as well. But before we get on, first off, I should say we're being joined right now by Hanna.
Hi guys.
Hi Hanna. Thanks for joining us.
The last time you visited us, we were playing pinball for like 10 hours straight.
That's true. Apparently, I'm the person who tags along with these guys when we go on wacky adventures.
You're our event guest.
That's true.
So, I think we should jump right into the experiences of the real-life Escape the Room that we did. It took place in San Francisco.
Yeah.
We should say in the beginning that, to some extent, there are spoilers to this experience. So I think that if you're listening and you want to go to one of these, and I think right now the only one that exists is in San Francisco.
Or if you want to fly to Japan, I suppose.
Or, yeah, that's also true. You could be in Japan. So feel free to not listen to this section, I think.
Well, I mean, I guess to retract it just a little bit, though, like, we told the folks that we're not going to be super explicit about the puzzles because, you know, if anyone does want to go to it, you know, if we're like, it's actually the Red 8, which, by the way, isn't part of the puzzle.
The Red 8 has nothing to do with the puzzle.
You know, that would completely reveal a huge section of the challenge. So, I mean, we won't, you know, we'll talk about them, the puzzles in the abstract, as if we were talking about, you know, adventure game puzzles, but we won't, you know, reveal the solutions, obviously. Right.
So we went in with a group of 11, 10 people?
I think we only had 9, actually. Yeah. We didn't have a full group.
Yeah, it was 9.
So we went in with a little fewer than the max.
Mm-hmm.
Which maybe explains how poorly we did. Before we went in, they briefed us about some of the things that we can expect. There's two people in the room who are staff, quote-unquote, the spirits in the mysterious room, who will direct us as needed or tell us not to touch things, which was a bit more common in this experience. Can you talk a little bit about what you saw or felt when the room first opened up and they closed the door and you were in it?
I guess it was pretty much sheer chaos in the beginning. Like, everyone just kind of running around, looking through things, trying to find clues. I mean, there was a little bit of leadership taken, but not enough, as it turns out. I think there was, like, one person taking notes and sort of ordering people around, but we obviously weren't as organized as we could have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, similarly, I guess, you know, this depends on puzzle to puzzle, too. You know, my first reaction was to look for some kind of unifying theme through the room, if there was going to be some sort of theme to the puzzle or something. And then, you know, failing that, I just started, you know that episode in Firefly where the governmental agents are like, tearing apart Firefly?
Yeah.
Like, and I remember this very clearly for some reason. There's one of the government soldiers picks up a placemat and looks under it on the table in Firefly, and then puts it back. Like, what, was River going to be hiding under a placemat? Like, what is he looking for? But that's how I felt, because I started leafing through, like, individual, you know, pages of a book and stuff like that. Like, just, like, really trying to figure out how detailed the mystery was going to get.
Right. The first thing that I did was I found a chair, and I started unscrewing the chair from its base. And now, you know, at this point,
and then someone told you to stop?
Well, no, so they didn't. And I was thinking, like, oh gosh, am I not supposed to do this? Like, am I breaking the boundaries here? And so the chair came apart, and I was done and I didn't find a clue. But then I noticed you could take it apart even further. So I started doing that. And that's when I started really getting nervous of thinking, gosh, maybe I'm not supposed to go this in depth. And then lo and behold.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty neat. Like, there were plenty of things where, you know, like a real life adventure game, everything, like, you know, the walls, you know, the panels on the walls, or like the stuffing in a particular, you know, I don't know, jacket or whatever, like, you know, there's little things. It's basically like a pixel hunt, except you're really doing it.
Yeah,
it's sort of the equivalent of tapping on every single square in the in the room, and except that you have physical objects.
Yeah, and everything in the room, almost everything, had a clue on it, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things I thought Yuki mentioned when we were talking with her after the experience was that the best tip she could give us was to be childlike in the room. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like you were being childlike? Did you feel like it had that sense of childlike whimsy?
I wish I would have thought about that going in, you know, to get into that mindset like she was describing.
Yeah.
You know, of course, without my mom yelling at me for ripping up things. And
right.
Because I think that would have helped us, really.
Yeah, I agree. I just thought it was an interesting way to wrap the theme around of, like, you know, you're in a puzzle and there's this challenge, but the thing that's going to get you the farthest is sort of forgetting that you're in that challenge and just having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, it definitely It definitely felt transgressive, like walking into a room, especially a room that isn't your own,
mm-hmm.
and
touching everything.
Yeah, let alone taking things apart, but like actually touch, you know, just straight up touching things mm-hmm. is something you're not supposed to do, either as an adult or as a child, and you know, that felt weird but fun.
Right. Do you feel like you guys fell into certain roles, like puzzle solving roles or tasks?
This is going to sound really predictable.
you saw the entire room as just pure mechanics.
All pixels.
Yeah, but also just on a larger meta level for you guys that know me personally, like at a certain point I felt pretty old in that room because like people were kind of like, people had this kind of youthful excitement that was actually deterring them from logically looking at the puzzle.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's an interesting social dynamic. Like, for example, there was, and, you know, this is where we can, you know, be somewhat vague but still illustrative of it. Like, there was something where we had to figure out a logic puzzle, you know, like kind of one of those things that you get on the SATs. Like, Bob likes Sally, but Sally only likes Rob, who likes Bob. You know, who does mm-hmm. Jeff like? And the way they were doing it, they were trying to do it too fast, and they were trying to do it kind of slapdash mm-hmm. style. And it's like, what you really need is to, like, stop kind of running and stop scribbling and line everything up logically, and then it will come together, you know?
Yeah, because there's a certain, like, that method of putting everything into a sort of visual shape before you start progressing through the puzzle really helps.
Right.
And I think if you played a lot of Professor Layton, you might know that.
It was very Layton-like.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want an indication of my personality or my and Scott's relationship, at that point, you came up to me and you were like, those guys are doing it wrong. You should go over there and help them. And I was like, nope. I'm doing my puzzle.
I was trying
Leave
to.
Leave me alone.
Well, I mean, that's the role that I fell into. Like, I started kind of floating around the room. And, like, no one wants to be that one guy who is just kind of jerkily ordering people around. But, yeah. like, I kind of went up to people in pairs or one-offs and was like, hey, you know, this thing really looks like it could be this. Maybe you could take a look at it here and help me out with this thing. And then kind of float over to another group mm-hmm. and ask them, have you checked out this thing? Maybe it would make sense if you wrote it down. Like, I was trying to kind of, like, ad hoc, you know, direct people a little bit, you know?
Yeah. They told us before we went into the room that it's good to have a leader, like someone yep. who mm-hmm. even tells people what to do.
Yep.
And it's very clear, I mean, within the first 10 minutes, that we really need a leader, right? Yes. I mean, one of the first things I started doing in my small portion of the room was suggesting people just start piling clues together. Because yep. people initially were just kind of keeping it to themselves, or they'd yell it out loud and then just put it right back down, as though anyone would remember that.
Yep.
But
yep.
like you said, there's
you those... need an inventory.
Right. Like, yeah. But there are those social dynamics where they are strangers, and even though they're having a good time and they agreed to partake in this challenge, you don't want to upset them.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that the example of the gentleman who was trying to figure out the logic puzzle is a good one, because he was having a difficult time with it, and he was taking a lot of time doing it, and yeah. others started helping him, and they were all taking a long time. So at one point, there was like five people in one corner of the room just trying to solve that one puzzle, which
right.
was just dragging down how long it took us to solve the entire mess of puzzles.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was one of the neat parts of the room overall, was that there were the mental challenges like that. There were challenges about wordplay mm-hmm. that if you didn't have a certain level of pop culture knowledge, you know, you'd be at more of a disadvantage. Yeah, so it makes sense to have a lot of people on your team.
Well, and like historical, almost trivia questions in a way.
Yeah. And then there was the... just like what Yuki was saying, like the childlike aspect to it. So if you have kind of a inquisitive person who's not afraid to, you know, mess up the room, that also helps your team. So like you really have to have this mix. A successful team, I could see, would have that mix of four elements, you know, a boss, an inquisitive person, a logic person, a puzzle person. And, you know, that's probably the key to getting out of the room.
Right, right. Do you think that the sense that you have to engage with others in that way sort of distracts from the whole experience? Because, you know, in a way, when you're playing Professor Layton or you're solving a escape the room puzzle online, you're all on your own, you know? Like,
yeah.
you're really just, it's testing you against the puzzle. You're pushing yourself against this wall, and either you figure it out or you don't, and that's that. It's on you.
Yeah.
Did you think, I mean, how do you think that that shaped this experience? Because there were so many people involved.
Well, it definitely made it more difficult. It was more exciting. Like, you know, if when you solve a puzzle in Professor Layton, you feel good. But, you know, when there's a whole room of people who are sort of cheering you on, it's, you know, it's a social experience in a different way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting. Like, I really, after going, I kind of want to go again and just watch.
Yeah.
Because I want to
do it. To be a spirit.
Well, I want to do it again to be, to do the puzzle again, but I realize that I can't. Like, it's a one-off thing.
Yeah.
Which actually, like, seems like a problem to me. Like, it's so much work for something that you can only do once. Yeah.
Welcome to video games.
It's permadeath.
Well,
it's basically permadeath.
No, I mean, like, with a video game, like, there's enough, especially if you've got hours of material, you can replay it to some extent, or you can replay it with a different difficulty level, or, you know, something like that. But with this experience, like, you can do it once, and that's kind of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd be curious to see how other groups were different, and, you know, it must be fun for the people who have the spirit jobs to see different groups attack it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. It felt to me, not at first, but towards the end when we... It was clear that we were generally kind of slowing down. We were sort of getting stuck. And so people started turning to each other for advice or for figuring things out. And people started switching roles in terms of what puzzles they were trying to solve. And in that moment, it felt more like we were just in a movie theater. Like, this is just a group of people watching a film and we're laughing along together. And the environment, the social environment is altering the experience. But it's fundamentally one in which we're all sort of just engaged in one general single thing.
You're saying it went from more every man for himself to more of a communal thing?
Yeah, like, you know, at one point, and I don't know if you got this, but it was maybe 40 minutes in when they said, you know, 40 minutes are in, you only have 20 minutes left, that I knew right then, we're probably not going to get out of here.
You got that sinking feeling.
Yeah, but instead of me feeling like I was frustrated, I felt like, okay, well, now let's just try to have a good time and just see how far we can get. And it became something where it wasn't about, oh gosh, how much can I contribute to my team, right? Like, I guess what I'm saying is just because this is a social game, it's so different from something like team-based Call of Duty or Natural Selection or League of Legends, right? Like, you're not relying on your team members in the same way, sort of.
Because of the competitive aspect or the lack of competitive aspect?
Yeah, I mean, partially it's the lack of the competitive aspect, but I think partially because you're all agreeing to engage in this sort of, I guess, magical circle, right? Like, you're all agreeing that you're... It almost felt like role-playing in a way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, that was one aspect where I was actually somewhat expecting that they would do more. Like, they would... I don't know what I was expecting, but I was kind of like... I had this idea that they might try to, like, make it more scenario-based. Yeah. Like
a monster would come out of the closet or something?
Yeah, or more narrative, I guess, is the best way to describe it. But it was almost stark in comparison to what I was expecting.
Yeah.
I think the time limit really contributes to getting along with people, actually.
Oh, really?
Because, well, I mean, I was thinking back on other sort of role-playing or... So anytime you have a group of people solving a problem together, even in like a work environment where you're on a project, like once you spend a certain amount of time with people and you're not making progress, that's when people start getting frustrated and start getting annoyed at each other.
Yeah.
And because we all knew, like, well, better or worse, like in 20 minutes, we're out of here.
That's true.
You know, it sort of relaxed it in a way where people didn't have time to get sort of too frustrated with each other.
Yeah, there was never a moment when I felt like someone was really giving up, you know, and my biggest fear, and this is a fear in RPGs, tabletop RPGs that is when someone just feels like, well, I can't contribute, so I'm going to sit this one out. Like, that's the worst. That really brings down everybody. And I think you're right, that hour time limit keeps that fire under your ass, so you're always moving and trying to help out and trying to think of things.
Yeah. How did you two feel about them giving us hints when it was... when it seemed like we were at an impasse and it seemed like the time was running short?
Well, I mean, it didn't save us, so... I mean, it's interesting, because I wonder... I mean, I think he gave us a little bit of an answer about when they decide to give hints and when they don't.
Yeah.
But that part must really be more of an art form than a science. Like, maybe they say, well, we don't give it till a certain time, but, like, I don't know, I'd be curious to ask them, like, how they actually decide when... when a group is just not going to get this and you have to give it to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like when we were talking with Kazu and Yuki, they almost said as much, you know, they've run this dozens of times, and so they must have a sense of when it's appropriate, even if it's not going to help them win, but when it's appropriate for them to continue to have a good time, because they kept on reiterating challenge, you know, like a part of it was supposed to be challenge. Like it wasn't supposed to be a purely experiential thing.
Yeah. It was definitely too little too late, right? Like we were already doomed at this point. And the things that they revealed were actually pretty significant, right? Like the location of one of the clues, one of the tools actually that we really needed to continue with the puzzle. And the other one was something that ended up being pretty clutch in terms of moving on. Mm-hmm. The room, and you know this the moment you walk in, has a second room attached to it. I think part of my feeling when they revealed those clues was that they just wanted us to see all of the puzzles that we could have solved. Yep. You know, I almost felt like they weren't doing it so that we had a closer chance of getting out of the room. I think by the time they showed us, they knew these guys are not getting out. Mm-hmm. But they wanted us to know, we have all of this for you, just so you know, like, this is a whole experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem of, you know, that's why so many games are front-loaded. Like, barely anyone finishes any type of game, whether it's, you know, an RPG or even something as simple as Gears of War. So, like, you have these front-loaded games, mm-hmm. you know?
I mean, when they showed one of the clues, I was genuinely startled, right? I was taken aback. I thought it was really neat when they showed us the location of it, and as well as when they revealed the second clue, because they were showing us something that I was not thinking about at all, and I don't think anybody was really thinking about. So it's still something that is a sort of like aha moment, even though it's not really yours to earn.
Mm-hmm. I kind of wish they would have done it after the 60 minutes had expired, still walked us through it.
And they did a lot of that afterwards.
They did, but, like, just from my own personal perspective, like, I felt it kind of took the wind out of my sails, the first hint that they gave, because at that point, even if we had one, it wouldn't have felt pure anymore.
Yeah, you know?
I don't know. Like, does that make sense, though?
No, it does. And, I think it does make sense. And I think that was compounded when they did two clues quite back-to-back.
Yeah.
Part of it is, I don't think we would have gotten out of the room, but I think we might have found those two clues on our own.
Yeah, it's always a potential, and like it would have been like desperation moments, you know. So that's kind of what I was interested in seeing. Like I wanted to see what would happen in those desperate last 5 minutes, but it was slightly less desperate because we kind of knew. I feel like there was like a tacit acceptance that because they had started helping us, we probably needed the help.
Right.
See, I thought that it was people sort of interpreted that in the opposite way. There were a couple of people talking after the game about how close they thought we actually were.
Uh-huh.
And I think that getting those clues toward the end made people feel like, oh, we must be almost there. And, you know, he's helping us because like we're going to get it. When in fact, it may have been the opposite, that he was helping us because he knew we weren't going to get it.
But that illusion that he created is fantastic, right? Like I think you're right.
Yeah.
They want people to think they're close even when we're not.
Yeah.
Well, and they want to make those last 5 minutes as exciting as possible. And I think because we got those clues, we were able to progress to enough of a point where we had a really exciting thing happening at the very end, even though, you know, it ultimately wasn't us getting out of the room.
Yeah.
There was also a cool moment I thought towards the end when the clues that we needed were now singular, right? We were genuinely following one path.
Yep.
And so the entire group of nine of us would run from one room to the other and one clue to the other. And it felt like that scene in Clue when everyone's sort of running around from room to room. It's kind
although I don't think that helped us, though.
No, I don't think so either. But in terms of like, in terms of making a fun experience, right? Like those moments were pretty capstone for me because it did feel like we were somewhat close, even though I now know that was mostly an illusion. And it made me feel physically close to everybody, right? Like we were having a very social experience. If this had been a scenario where some of us were having the really tight excitement and others were in a corner trying to think of solutions to other problems, I don't think I would have had that same sort of social experience.
Yeah, but tellingly, that's how the puzzle would have been solved. Like, there would have to be people doing... Yeah. Like, I mean, it's how we landed on the moon. There's some dude grinding away on a slide rule, right. And there's someone actually walking on the moon. That's you know, true. Like, I mean,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
In order to actually solve the puzzle, we just needed more structure, you know?
I mean, I think the very bitter end, like, at the very last moment, maybe you would have that same level of excitement, but you're right. Like, we would never have gotten to that moment anyway, yeah. So they might as well feed us.
Exactly. Yeah. Might as well run around like the mystery.
No, you're not allowed to run.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
we what did she say? Walk brisk walking quickly. Brisk walk. Yeah, walk briskly.
We explicitly broke the rules by running at a certain point.
But you know, even the fact that we broke those rules, I think, is indicative of everyone was sort of partaking in that illusion happily.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really enjoyed the idea that the entire place was a very designed space. You know, like I liked that. When they walked us through the very end and they were showing off some of the puzzles, both the ones that we did succeed and the ones that we didn't get, it felt right to me because someone had thought everything through and it seemed like it made sense. Mm-hmm. And even though it didn't feel like an hour was enough time for if it were myself to truly get it, I did feel like someone put in enough work that even if I'm walking away from this without escaping, I feel like I put my money towards a sound investment.
Yeah, which is just our way of saying you should do this because Professor Layton should have all the fun. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
What other places would you like to escape from?
Yeah, so they asked us this question when we got out of the room.
Yeah.
Yeah, I put down hospital.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I thought that would be fun. But I'm thinking like a Silent Hill themed one where it's really terrifying.
Like Pyramid Head is walking around.
I want to, because, you know, so much of this puzzle was just sort of thinking about what you're doing. I mean, there's a lot of running around and flipping shit over, but what if your time constraint was like 5 rooms and you had to get out of the room, otherwise you died, you know, something like that. I think that would add a cool, fun layer to it.
It's like that game show in Japan where the floor opens up.
Yeah, like add a more physical component.
That's gonna knock the ticket price up a bit.
Or, you know, what?
Or what, gotta pay those lawyers.
What if you had an experience like this, but there was a mole in your group, right? Yeah. And they were undermining your effort, and part of success was figuring out who that mole was. Like, that could be so cool.
I guess the puzzle was hard enough. I don't really feel the need to add on. I see why those things would be fun, but like, I don't see the need to make it any more challenging than it already was.
Yeah.
I thought the idea of doing it in a bus or a train would be cool because...
Like a moving bus or a moving train.
Well, that could be... I mean,
again,
I was...
the lawyers.
Well, I mean, because those spaces are generally enclosed and you feel like there's very little mystery in those spaces. But in reality, it would just be interesting to see how mysterious those mundane spaces could get because there are access panels, there are things under the seats... There are, you know, patterns that you could do with seat arrangement and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, having an area where you feel like you're pretty much aware of everything that's going on, but having a mystery inside of it and an enclosed space, I thought would be pretty cool.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah, that'd be fun. Did you find that the game was too hard? Like, do you think the difficulty was too much?
Yeah, I thought it was okay. I mean...
I thought it was about right. I mean...
How many Picarits worth of difficulty is this?
I mean, they said that three groups had solved it out of...
Like 50-something?
Yeah, we were number 56.
So as of January 12th, it's 3 out of 57 teams.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty brave to... I mean, we say this about any game designer. It's pretty brave to make a game that you know is going to be challenging, if not inaccessible, to the majority of your audience.
Yeah.
So it's like you're playing the real-life Demon Souls at a point.
Yeah, but how much of a ripoff would it have been if we escaped after 20 minutes?
That would be amazing.
Well, if we just thought we were super smart.
We just guessed the like location of the key or something.
Oh, it's a hippopotamus. Ding, 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 ding.
Like you, I think the difficulty felt good to me, but when I think about if I do this again, it's a little weird going into an experience knowing, well, I'm really unlikely to succeed.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it would
be... knew. I mean, they told us that because we asked before we even went in there how many people had solved
true.
It. So
yeah.
We kind of knew going in.
But you always have a hope, right? Like you always think that maybe we'll be the ones who can get out.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
But then you find the crushing reality that lies within the room.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which is too many clues, and you can't find them all.
But one of the last things I want to mention that I thought was really neat was that. It felt like it was pretty similar to a lot of the Escape the Room puzzles that I've played, except for the physical nature of everything was so neat. Like, I think that was one of my favorite aspects of it. And one of my favorite moments was when we had failed and they turned all the lights on and the, you know, the music died down or whatever, and they were talking to us about the puzzle, we all sort of stopped and looked around at the mess we'd made.
Yep.
Yeah, we weren't even aware of it until the woman walked in. She's like, wow, you guys really, yeah.
I mean, it was trash, right? There was like couch. It was like The Hangover or something, right? Like a dorm room.
There was a tiger in there.
Yeah, it was insane. And it was so cool to see a physical manifestation of the progress that you made, right? Because at some point it's not about, okay, well, we're not going to get out of here, but how far can we go? And and that progress, all of those accomplishments are like written in the physical objects that are just strewn about randomly.
Yeah, I thought that was neat as well.
Any other things, any highlights, favorite moments or aspects of the experience?
This is a kind of a weird thing, but I liked the elevator ride up to the lobby because there was this weird energy of people were a bit nervous, but also a bit excited at the same time.
Yeah.
Definitely. And that was like the closest proximity that we were with everyone because we were all crammed into an elevator together.
That's true, yeah. Right,
yeah.
This is the room. Congratulations.
We have to get out of this. Once it closes, we have to get out of the elevator. We have to see her inside.
The elevator moves
sideways.
I keep coming back to this moment, which I can't describe in detail because it's a spoiler. There was something at the end that was part of the solution that involved a clue that I didn't even know had been found. Mm-hmm. Like, I was so buried in the puzzle I was working on that I had no idea this clue existed. And when I found out that it was there, I was sure that I could have solved that part of the puzzle. I'm probably wrong. I probably couldn't have done that, but it's kind of nagging at me that, like, why didn't I look up and look around and see that thing and make that connection?
Yeah.
So
you need a manager to manage all the teams and keep all the knowledge.
Well, it's keeping all the knowledge, but it's also, like, on the other hand, making sure that you have enough eyes on each puzzle, because what happens when a puzzle is in the hands of the wrong person?
Yeah.
And how does that slow everybody else down when they might not even know that that's the puzzle that's being worked on?
Yeah, or just forgetting it, right? Like, when I think back of why we failed for all of the reasons we knew people fail in general. Like, there was nothing surprising about why. We didn't have someone who could hurt us effectively. We didn't really take good notes, realistically. And we forgot about puzzles.
Yep.
Or we didn't, or like Hannah said, right? We didn't take a look at certain ones that maybe we could have helped on.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, and we also spent a lot of time. I know I spent a lot of time on something that I ended up having a missing piece for. Like starting, it's like cooking a recipe without reading the whole thing first. Like, or like I'm gonna cook this thing, but I'm missing this really key ingredient. Like, you know, just the sheer fact of making sure you have all the information before you start working on something is like, it's so basic. And I don't think I was the only one that failed at it.
Yeah.
I hope not.
You're to blame, Hanna.
Well, you know.
We're actually still stuck in the room recording this.
It's true.
This is our last testament.
This is 3 days without food and water. We ate the eight other guests. Still podcasting. Do you think that playing like video game Escape the Room puzzles or similar point and click adventures helped in any way?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So you can train then?
Yeah, because, I mean, you train to... A, you get better at logic puzzles, and you get better at you know, math things and wordplay by practicing.
That's true.
And B, if you're used to pixel hunting, then messing stuff up is not, you know... there's not as much of a psychic barrier, you know, between you and that and the actual act.
Well, then I think before we do our next Escape the Room puzzle, we should train. Like, we should have, like, marathon sessions.
Like, montage-worthy.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing, Scott. We failed escaping from the room. That can't happen again.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying.
The Cobra Dojo Escape the Room guys can't.
Don't you think that, like, the tendency, though, of people who play a lot of games to game the game, don't you think that hurt us more than it helped us?
I don't know. Do you think? How so?
Well, so, like, you would have somebody looking at something that could be a clue or couldn't be a clue, and then spending time and energy, like, figuring that out and drawing on all of their past experiences. And I don't know that that was that useful.
No, I think you make a really good point. I was definitely overthinking some problems. Like, I started thinking of metaphors of, like, maybe this thing was related to this thing when it's definitely not.
Yeah, or maybe, like, the color is significant when it wasn't, or not that it was or wasn't. I don't know. There was a certain amount of overthinking, I think, that may have been a result of too many adventure games.
And realistically, that's a common...
Or not enough.
I think that's a common thing in puzzle games anyway, right? Because I know sometimes the clues to a Professor Layton puzzle will read, this is relatively simple, don't overthink it. Something as simple as that can push you in the right direction.
Or the simple frustration of, like, having a solution that isn't the solution.
Mm-hmm.
That was very much manifest.
When it becomes something where it's trial and error, you're doing it wrong, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, and there was a couple points, I guess, where we had some guesses, but we hadn't narrowed down each one, and that was definitely a point where it kind of went south.
Yeah. Well, overall, I had a really good time. Did you guys have a really good time?
Definitely.
Yeah, me too.
Cool. Well, I think if listeners want to escape the room, they should try it. You know what? What you could try is just have a friend set it up, lock the door in your bedroom, have at it.
Yeah, and then just completely mess up your
bedroom.
That's
so much work.
Just flip over the bed.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to see their checklists for when they have to set the room back up at the end.
They probably just put it wherever they want.
I don't think so.
Really?
I think they just burn it all down.
I bet there's a map. Well, what I really want to know, this is, I want to ask them a bunch more questions, but what I really want to know is what they do if something doesn't get into the room.
Oh, yeah, like what if someone steals a clue?
Like, yeah, if somebody stole, because there's a lot of small objects involved, mm-hmm. so, like, something could easily get misplaced or stolen or hidden or something, and then what do they do? Because they're on walkie-talkies, they're in the room. Do they see where it's supposed to be and then figure it out and then try to slip it in? Or, like, I really want to know how that works. Or maybe they're just perfect and they never miss up. I don't know.
There's only three crew members, you know.
That's
so
true.
It's
that's
like,
that's probably,
you know, you
usually
don't
in my experience
things.
When there's something like that happens, it's usually on a where there's a relatively large group
right.
of people who could be messing it up.
Yeah.
I mean, simply put, it comes up because the order that the room was in when we went in and the chaos that it was in when we left is startling. So
yeah.
they you know, in terms of just designing it as a puzzle space, they did a really good job.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, shall we wrap up?
Yeah, let's wrap up. I mean, as always, if you want to reach us, any thoughts or questions, experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
Oh, and of course, we should give a special thanks to Mateus, Yuki, and Kazu for talking with us about Escape the Room puzzles, both the digital ones and the real-life ones.
All right. And Hannah, thanks for being on the podcast once again.
Sure, it was fun.
Thanks.
And everyone else, thanks for listening.
Bye.
Have a good one.
Bye.